Investors Chronicle.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to the IC Companies and Markets podcast. My name is Mark Robinson, and I'm standing in for Dan Jones this week, who is gallivanting around the Dodecanese Islands at the moment, probably taking in the glories of ancient Greece or perhaps even the Ottoman Empire. I'm joined this week by my colleagues Julian Hoffman and Gemma Slingo. Julian and I will be talking a little bit about a payments specialist in a moment. And Gemma is the author of this week's cover feature, which has passed me by to a certain degree. So she'll be explaining it to me in some detail a little bit later. First, a couple of thoughts for the week as well. I don't know if you've experienced this in recent times, Julian, but I have noticed that companies seem to be getting slightly more anxious about their ability to refinance. That's in the wake of the Bank of England's 50 basis point increase. And
also that our water companies are about to go down the drain, as it were.
Oh, yes. I was going to mention that too. That's something that we'll be looking at in the magazine over the next couple of weeks. I'm reliably informed. But even though we're approaching the main half-year reporting season at the moment, but what I've seen in the comments in various companies at the moment is that they're paying a little bit more attention to their balance sheet now and the multiples contained within. I had a sort of a fairly fractious dispute with a listed company last week, which will go unnamed for litigation purposes. And they seem to think, they took issue with the fact that we include IFRS 16 within our debt calculations as well, which seemed rather peculiar at the time, given that their business depends to a large degree on big box premises and storage yards. But they didn't seem to think that an increase in the leasehold arrangement would have any material impact on their borrowing, which is a strange set of circumstances, to say the least, because we've got to realize that when interest rates go up as well, a lot of the providers of said premises are also going to need to pass those costs along. It's not an ideal scenario for listed companies at the moment, but that's where we are. Julian, you've been around the traps long enough to realize what's happening in the debt markets, but are there any parallels with the type of sort of problems that we had in 2007, 2008? I know there was obviously a specific real estate element to all that and the problems in the derivative markets. But do you think we're going to see a significant rise in debt delinquencies this time around?
I think it's probably on the cards. I mean, a lot of companies have seen their debt payments go up by 20% in a quarter, which is, I mean, if you're sitting on £14 billion worth of debt, as Thames Water is, that is a very significant increase in your operating costs. I don't think the problem last time really was about the mispricing of risk. I don't think that's an issue now. It's more it's about the pricing of assets in the interim, which are going to cause the problems. For banks and insurers and stuff, they're sitting on, just for example, corporate bonds that you're losing value, and that has to do with rising interest rates, so the yields on those go up. Yeah, so it's an interesting time, to say the least. But yes, I mean, the water companies are the emblematic failure, really, of risk management in that sense. And I wouldn't be surprised if Thames isn't the only one that has to have a interesting chat with the regulators.
Yeah, I think we've highlighted this in the past, but it's public knowledge anyway, the level of leverage that has been taken on since those series of privatizations as well. But of course, it's all been masked by the fact that we had an unprecedented period of ultra low interest rates. They're bond proxies by definition, I guess. So the feeling always was as well, because their markets are regulated to the nth degree, really. So you would think that when deliberations are made about how much they can pay out in dividends through the year, that they would have taken those debts into consideration, but that will become clear over the the coming months. Not many results out over the last couple of weeks, as I'm sure all my colleagues have realized. We're heading towards that main half-year reporting season, which is always fun. But we did look at one interesting result this week. It's a payment specialist, Wise, and it's one of those companies that actually has benefited from the interest rate hikes we've seen.
That's right. It used to be called TransferWise.
That's right.
They changed their name to Wise. The company has built this kind of niche in alternative banking, I guess you could call it. It's almost like alternative banking.
Yeah.
Except they don't lend money. And they basically specialize in giving tourists and possibly this kind of expats who work abroad the option of transferring money in local currency at very, very low rates. So that's their defining business model. They've done quite well. They listed, I think, 3 years ago now.
Yeah.
And so this, yeah, the results are starting to show sort of mature comparators. So that's partly as well why we looked at them in more depth this time, or when Arthur wrote the story. And the key feature is also that they're one of the few that benefits from vast income when interest rates go up. So one of the benefits of being a transfer company is that, especially if you're dealing with a lot of people who are just going on holiday two or three times a year, is that the balances that are left tend to just sit in the account. So Wise doesn't pay the interest to its customers. It just keeps it from what's that there. It isn't, remember, it's not a bank. It doesn't offer income.
Yeah.
So it does have that a very plausible business model when rates are high. So it's, you know, the interest income was mainly but why its sales increased by 73% in the year, and that kind of offset you know, relatively high marketing spend. So it was quite a good result for them, really. But I don't know, I mean, whether it was entirely their own efforts is open to interpretation, I would say.
Yeah, they're in a sweet spot at the moment, and those growth rates were in excess of consensus expectations as well. Arthur makes that point. The cash margin as well increased by a fairly hefty 2.9 percentage points, up to 24.7%. So, you know, the business is obviously in a favorable position at the moment. Arthur also made the point that about two-thirds of their new customers joined through word of mouth, which, as we all know, is the most effective form of generating business because it doesn't entail marketing costs as well. So they're in a pretty good space at the moment. Looking at the valuation, Julian, I mean, the forward rating is 27 times forecast earnings. Arthur seems to think this is a bit expensive, but mind you, if you'd asked that same question to him 18 months, 2 years ago, he'd have said, oh, that's actually not that bad.
Well, it depends on how much faith you have in the long-term viability of the business, in that it's a relatively easy business to copy. And, you know, Wise has a proliferating number of competitors doing more or less the same thing. So it's not a moat that's protecting the business particularly. You've got to just think of it as first mover advantage. I think that would be its main selling point, and the fact that it's built a business quite quickly in 3 or 4 years, based on a relatively modest amount of, as you say, a modest amount of marketing. And once it has that brand recognition, it's one that people tend to stick with, I think. Particularly if you're only going on holiday every so often, you're never going to bother to sign up with a suite of, you know, transfer companies just to see who can give you, you know, 0.1% instead of 0.2% on your euro charges. So yes, it is a high valuation, and it reflects their growth, but I would say it's kind of slightly brittle, would be my interpretation of it.
Okay, so they're buying into that projected growth, but the fact is it's not a strong moat, in your opinion. I guess the high street banks as well do offer certain alternatives as well, because if you're traveling on the continent, for instance, I know that Lloyd's of whom I'm stable with, offer euro accounts as well. But we shall see. Arthur, the last point he makes as well, that because we're seeing rising immigration and cross-border transactions, that feeds into the investment case too. But as you say, it's quite easy for a disruptor to be disrupted itself.
Yeah, they also get criticism for the fact that they're relatively easy to circumvent their controls. I mean, this is kind of transfer companies generally, not just we're not just picking on Wise, but you know, there was an investigation about how you could just give a completely false address and you would end up being able to use a kind of a transfer bank account.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there's kind of there are sort of background issues, but it is, you know, for the fact that it doesn't have a huge capital base, it's generating really quite good growth. And I mean, the question is whether that, as the market matures, whether that will continue at that pace, really.
Now we're going to move on to this week's cover feature, which is relates to the attention economy. Now, the author, Gemma Slingo, is with us here. Gemma, this is a generational thing, but it sort of passed me by a lot of the details, even though it's a very interesting article. So, I mean, what actually is the attention economy, and why is it relevant to investors now?
Hi, Mark. It basically refers to the idea that attention is a valuable resource, basically, that can be fought over by companies. And as you say, it is a relatively new phenomenon. So in my cover feature, I mention a book by a former Google engineer, I think he is, which makes the argument that for most of human history, we've only had access to quite limited amounts of information. So that might be through books or newspapers or word of mouth. But the arrival of digital computing, and particularly the iPhone, means that we're now constantly surrounded by this information. And human attention has actually become the scarce and valuable thing, and the thing that basically companies want to get a piece of. So the article looks at how different companies are competing for our attention, how they seem to be getting on, and in a way, what that tells us about our own collective state of mind.
Oh, clearly, I haven't been paying attention in this regard as well. So it's another intangible that companies are looking to exploit. Why is it getting harder for companies to monetize the human attention?
If you think about the companies that are interested in it, it might be big tech companies, publishing companies, TV companies. And one of the main ways they make money is through advertising. And obviously, I'm sure we've discussed on the podcast before, that's been really struggling over the last few months. So you've had loads of updates from companies like ITV or Reach, S4 Capital, different advertising agencies basically warning that the market is getting pretty tough and clients are reining in their advertising spend. So that's one thing I discuss in the piece, sort of people, because of the market conditions, it's much harder to make money from the customers.
I guess that's a familiar refrain, even given conventional advertising channels too. We've seen that in the past. There's a contra theory that runs that companies have become, in some cases, a little bit more willing to spend on marketing during economic downturns in order to sustain or increase their market share. But that's a separate story altogether. Now, bearing this in mind, are you seeing any signs of improvement in the advertising market at the moment?
I think it depends where you look. So I think the more traditional media and entertainment companies are where you see the real struggles. But even the big tech companies like Google and Meta have seen a decline in advertising revenue, but that was mainly last year. And we have seen a bit of a bounce back in growth, and you can see it reflected in the share price, as Arthur discussed in his recent cover feature about Meta. But I think what's also interesting is the way that companies are able to advertise and try and grab our attention seems to have fundamentally changed since, I don't know, over the last 2 years, really, if not a shorter period of time. So in the piece, I talk about how everyone, and particularly young people, seems to be hooked on this short form video, which are basically video clips that are about a minute or less, and seems to be linked to this idea that our attention spans are actually getting shorter. But that sort of footage is actually really hard to monetize because it's so short. It's hard to actually get an advert in there. So I talk a little bit about how the way that big tech has affected our minds is actually sort of shot themselves in the foot a little bit, because it then becomes a lot harder to monetize the sort of content they're trying to flog.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that the future of advertising being linked in with the kind of mass psychosis in the in the general population. That might be a rather crude way of putting it. I mean, one of the advantages of digital advertising, one that's often expressed, is the fact that it's much easier to tailor it to individual needs as well. But that doesn't say much about a collective response. So if I was an investor as well, are there ways to access that kind of economy, you know, beyond looking at big tech, the Metas and Netflix of this world?
In the piece, I do try and trace the supply chain back a little bit, because I think we often become really obsessed with the tech disruptors and the big names and thinking of what way their share prices are going to go. But actually, if you trace it back a little bit, you come to a lesser known subset of companies. Maybe they might be manufacturers or distributors who sort of feed off the same content creation, but they're less well known, probably a bit smaller, and maybe a little bit more reliable. I don't want to give away too much of what's in the piece, but I try and identify two or three which investors might be interested in. But again, it's not a fail-safe strategy, is the conclusion I came to, because I think people thought for a while coming out of the pandemic that content creation was not really cyclical. Everyone wanted to be an influencer, or everyone was filming things, and that was a sort of fail-safe strategy. But I think the last few months have definitely burst the bubble in that way.
If you're going to go down this road as well, you're looking at growth strategies really as well, because that whole quarter of the market is evolving, as you say, far too rapidly for me. Julian, do you have any thoughts on this? It's an area which is, as I say before, has rather passed me by, unfortunately, like so much else in life.
I think I can join you in that school. I'm not sure that. I mean, it's there in almost everything we do online, but I don't really understand the appeal or the economics of it, to be honest. But yes, I'm sure that Gemma has done an excellent job of explaining it in her piece.
Well, no doubt about it. So we'll obviously leave that with Gemma and Arthur and the youth of today, the old brave new world. I think probably that's about it for this week as well. It's a sort of slightly short edition, unfortunately, but not a big great deal has been happening on the announcements front, but that's going to change very shortly. So I'd just like to thank both Gemma and Julian for their contributions this week. And hopefully by the next time that you listen to us, the lessons of the attention economy will have sunk in. Until then, goodbye.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.